From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Kenneth C. Davis is my guest. His famous book, Don't Know Much About History, was first published in 1990 and spent weeks and weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. Mr. Davis' dry wit helped make history fun for those who do not find it inherently fun. The success of the book spawned a I Don't Know Much About series. Now, Don't Know Much About History is back with an expanded anniversary edition with a red, white, and blue cover. Ken Davis, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure to be with you. Looking forward to it.
Well, you know, as you point out in your book, for years, Jay Leno has been asking average Americans questions about American history on his show. And although the results are supposed to be hilarious, I mostly find them really sad.
Despite, it is sad, you're right.
You know, despite your having sold zillions of copies of the original Don't Know Much About History, Americans still don't know much about anything. Why don't we know stuff?
It's a really good question, and it's a really important question, and I've been asking it for about 20 years and trying to do something about it. I think it comes down to a couple of very, very basic things. First of all, the way we teach history and the amount of time we spend on it. It's that simple. We spend very little time on American history. You get a little in grade school, of course, learning about the Pilgrims and the Mayflower. And then you get a little bit in junior high or middle school. It gets a little bit more sophisticated. And then most people get maybe 1 year of American history in high school. So we just don't spend enough time on it, and then we have too much of it left to the mass media to teach us. So an awful lot of people grow up, children especially, thinking that Pocahontas was a busty woman in a deerskin dress.
I saw her. I know that's her. I saw her in the movie, and she was.
Yeah, you saw the movie, and
she was drawn beautifully.
Had this Pocahontas lunch pail from Disney, the lunchbox. So, you know, that's part of the problem as well. But much sadder and much worse is the fact that even when we do teach it, it's boring. Most people say, "Oh, American history, it was so dull. It was all those dates and battles and speeches." So we have this incredibly fascinating human story about real people doing extraordinary real things in real places, but we reduce it to a long list of dates and battles and speeches that we have to memorize for the final exam, and then we forget about just as soon as we close the exam book. That's not only sad, it's dangerous. It's sad because I try and tell stories of real people, and I try and have some fun doing it, and I try and do it in a language that people understand, not in academics. The other thing is that it's dangerous because if we don't understand history, we don't know who we are, we don't know how we got here, we don't understand our rights, and we certainly don't understand the tremendous sacrifices that were made to give us those rights. So that's a crusade for me, and I happen to love it. I don't know if you can hear my enthusiasm for American history, but I hope so.
Well, when you and I were kids, they used to teach American history in two parts. First, there's part one, which is from Columbus to the Civil War, and then part two, from Reconstruction to the present. And at that time, the present wasn't that long. But now, you know, there's been an additional however many years since we were kids. And so now they break up history into two parts, from the beginning until the Civil War, and then from Reconstruction to the present. It's still the same two parts.
And there's a lot more present to deal with. You're absolutely right. So yeah, that's certainly part of the challenge of history and certainly teaching history. And I've had many conversations about this recently because people are wondering, well, how are schools teaching 9/11? It's 10 years later. It's in the textbooks now. I was actually reading a very interesting story about how 9/11 is actually presented in textbooks, not only in the United States, but around the world. And it's a fascinating story because it shows that people bring a perspective to the story, that it fits into a narrative, and that's one of the other reasons that the way we teach history is so dangerous. We've always given a sort of spin, if you will, to the story. So for a long time, and certainly when I was a kid growing up in the 60s, history was mostly about those wonderful white guys who founded the country and did no wrong. And we know now that that story wasn't as simple. And certainly what I tried to do in Don't Know Much About History was bring to light some of the stories that were left out of my textbooks, the stories of African Americans and women and Native Americans, the stories that were hidden from the textbooks. And I've actually had a whole cottage industry about of books about the things that our textbooks leave out. And it's not only dangerous, as I mentioned before, but it's sad because these are really good stories. The story of the real first pilgrims in America who were French and came to Florida 50 years before the Mayflower sailed is an amazing story, but most of us never hear it. They were actually wiped out by the Spanish in what was essentially a religious bloodbath. What story is more important in our times, but most of us have never heard that story?
Well, when you first published Don't Know Much About History back in 1990, there had been some controversy around the books like The Closing of the American Mind and the, I can't remember the other one, about American...
Cultural literacy was there around that time.
Cultural literacy. And you were kind of accused of being a flaming liberal in the way that you... in the way that you... presented, and the fact that you were even trying to present history, I guess, made you a flaming liberal. And so what I'm wondering is, has that accusation become more fervent now that you're talking about really recent American history in your new book, which has a gigantic section, I mean a huge section, that deals with things that happened since 1990?
That's correct. The update for people who are familiar with the book, the new edition adds an extensive amount of material about the past decade in America, basically moving from the events of 9/11 through the two wars that were that came about in its wake, the Great Recession, the economic meltdown, the rise of the same-sex marriage as a national issue.
See, there
and
you go.
Of course, pardon?
There you go.
Well, you know, I'm not saying that that's liberal. I'm saying that I'm presenting that because that's a significant piece of our history and an extraordinary change in American life and culture. So I'm presenting that. And just to go back to this question of liberal, I've always, personally am more on the progressive side, I would say. But I don't feel that the book was ever truly, you know, a liberal book. I mean, if liberal means that you're telling about African Americans and women and Native Americans, and you're telling that Thomas Jefferson and George Washington were quite extraordinary, but they weren't perfect and flawless, I guess, you know, that makes me a liberal. But I always felt that I was pretty much an equal opportunity basher. I mean, certainly don't go easy on Lyndon Johnson or John F. Kennedy or Franklin D. Roosevelt, for that matter. Every president that I know of has made mistakes. Even those presidents who we think of as great progressives, going back as far as Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson took this nation backwards in race relations about 30, 40 years, if not longer, when he was president. It's also interesting to note he was the last president born into a slave-holding household. Most people don't know much about Woodrow Wilson to begin with, but are surprised to learn that a man who became president in 1912 was born in a house where slaves still ran the household, and that was true in Woodrow Wilson's case, born in Virginia in the early 1860s.
Now, we're talking with Kenneth Davis, and his famous book, Don't Know Much About History, is now out in the expanded anniversary edition. Well, it's interesting how history will revise personalities in history. I mean, for instance, you know, we used to think of Dwight Eisenhower as a very boring president, a boring period in American history, or Ronald Reagan. I mean, I think today Ronald Reagan is thought of as one of the great leaders. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, all of these presidents and I think and talk and write about presidents a great deal, get kind of, I guess, heroized, you know, mythologized, turned into legends pretty much the day they die. And it seems that we go through this process with a Ronald Reagan or a Dwight Eisenhower of they are flawless in death, and we know better than that. Certainly Ronald Reagan was not flawless in life. It's very, very difficult these days, especially if you're speaking to a conservative or a Republican audience, and I point to that debate, so-called debate in California last week of the Republican candidates. I mean, every other word out of their mouths was some kind of homage to Ronald Reagan, and of course the debate was held at the Ronald Reagan Library, and the plane was there, and Mrs. Reagan was there, and it's all understandable, but as historians, we have to try and strike a little balance, and I try and be fair and balanced. What Ronald Reagan accomplished was extraordinary in many ways. You had a series, if you go back to the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963, you had an assassinated president, you had a flawed, deeply flawed presidency in Lyndon Johnson, who had to not run again when he could have because of the disaster of Vietnam. He's followed by Nixon, who has to resign because of Watergate. He's then followed by Gerald Ford, an unelected president. He's then followed by Jimmy Carter, largely viewed as a failed president. So you had this really long string of failed or tarnished presidents, and then Ronald Reagan comes along with this Morning in America, and he really did transform, and I say this admiringly, people's vision of the White House, the presidency, perhaps America to a degree, but that's not to say he did not make mistakes, some of them very serious mistakes. I think that I spend a lot of time in the book discussing Iran-Contra and what a grave constitutional crisis it was, but that Ronald Reagan's personal popularity probably kept him from being more sharply rebuked and even perhaps even impeached by the Congress at that time. It would have been politically very, very difficult to impeach Ronald Reagan for what might have been high crimes and misdemeanors.
But did that same kind of idolization of a past president occur when Andrew Johnson died?
Andrew Johnson in Lincoln's successor.
Yeah.
Well, no, not really, because he was viewed pretty much as a failed president. You'll remember he was the first president to be impeached. His views of Reconstruction were largely unpopular. He was the first and only president to return to the Senate after he actually was not renominated, which is interesting. And so, no, I don't think that he was quite given that same treatment, but it's also different because he was a successor president. He was not an elected president. Certainly Lincoln, you can look at him as an example of how presidents are deified in death, in a sense. Lincoln was never as popular in life as he was in death, and I'm not being glib when I say that. He was hated and criticized roundly and thoroughly throughout his presidency, especially in the early years of the Civil War when things were not going well. He was depicted in some newspapers as a guerrilla, and that was clearly a very, very racist and deliberately so depiction of him. And so in 1864, when he's running for re-election, he's actually quite convinced that he's not going to win again. And it's only the turnabout on the field of battle, there are some victories that change his fortunes, and the fact that he was running against an utterly incompetent opponent, one of the generals he had fired, McClellan.
Right. Yes, McClellan. Well,
You mentioned, now that you mentioned Lincoln, I'm thinking about something. There's so much I wanted to ask you about, but then we're going to try to shut
up. A lot of history to cover.
Well, in your book, you talked a little bit about the conspiracy theories around 9/11, and you address them in the book, and you pretty much say, I think you, I can't remember the quote, but you say it's bad, you know, it's unhealthy speculation. It's bad, you know, it's bad rumoring. But so I want to ask you a little bit about the next most famous conspiracy. I mean, I think there was a conspiracy to kill President Lincoln. What about President Kennedy? Do you think there was a conspiracy there?
That's the one we still, you know, ache in our hearts and in our somewhere in the back of our minds about, because I have, of course, read all of the reports over the years and understand the skepticism. I think that a healthy skepticism, let me just say this in the general sense, whether we're talking about Pearl Harbor or 9/11 or you know, the notion that AIDS was a conspiracy brought about by the CIA that threw drugs in the inner city, which was a conspiracy theory that was making the rounds. In the internet age, these things become much more pronounced. I, like a lot of people, feel that the explanation of Lee Harvey Oswald being the lone killer was never quite satisfying. On the other hand, I've never been convinced by any of the speculation about involvement, and some of the wildest speculation really damages the notion that there could be some skepticism here. But I don't think that. I think I'm content in believing that some of the books, like the Posner book, for instance, or the Bellin book, he was an investigator for the Warren Commission, have pretty much put to rest most of the suspicions about the Kennedy conspiracy. But still, there's something that nags at all of us about it. It just doesn't quite feel right, does it? So as a historian, I'm always open to the fact that and the idea that we could learn something new. But to date, I've not read or seen anything so compelling, so convincing, as to make me believe that what we've been told about Lee Harvey Oswald is not the complete truth. But I wouldn't be surprised if someday we learn something else.
There are many milestones in your book that you use to discuss how these, and I think it's one of the themes of your book, how this moment in history affects the rest of history, which is why we study history to begin with. And you use the Versailles Treaty, for instance. So when we're talking about the last, 10 years in American history, you know, we all think of 9/11 as this turning point, but would it be fair to say that the Supreme Court decision of 2000 is just as crucial, or maybe even Monica Lewinsky is just as crucial a person? I mean, could that be the most costly fellatio in history?
Well, no one's ever asked me that question before, but that's an interesting way to put it. I believe that the election the election of 2000, and it seems so long ago now, doesn't it? It seems like a century ago rather than 11 years ago that we were going through Gore v. Bush at the Supreme Court and hanging chads versus dimpled chads. It just seems so long ago. But that was a watershed moment in our history. And I'm not sure if the Monica Lewinsky was really the thing that kept Al Gore from being elected president. I do think that the controversy in Florida was not well settled and appropriately settled, and I felt like many people that the Supreme Court ultimately deciding this election was not what the founding fathers had in mind when they set this whole thing up. So, I will always feel that it was a tainted election in some respects, and certainly we can't begin to speculate on what might have happened differently, because every time you change the way one domino falls, as you know, every science fiction writer will tell you, it changes the whole course of things. So, you know, would history have played itself out the same way? Obviously not, and that's not really the historian's job. We do look at moments and say, this is a moment that certainly changed the course of history, but we can't speculate on what might have been different, you know, if Al Gore had been president on 10 years ago as opposed to George Bush. Would the course of history been different? Undoubtedly it would have been, but how is impossible to answer.
Well, Ken Davis, can you compare the election of Al Gore, George W. Bush, with the Tilden Hayes election of...
Well, now you've got everyone scratching their heads. What do you mean, the Tilden Hayes? This was an extraordinary election also in American history. It was in 1876, a country celebrating its centennial, of course. And Samuel Tilden was a reform candidate, governor of New York, and Hayes was the Republican candidate. And there was a dispute over the electors from, believe it or not, Florida. Were the electors, and this related to whether these people had given their oath to rejoin the Union properly. And so this was turned over to a commission to decide which of the two candidates, and Tilden had won the popular vote, by the way. So the vote was turned over to a commission, not the Supreme Court, but a commission to rule on who would get these contested electoral votes. And it's clear that there was fraud involved and all sorts of backroom dealings involved. But it basically came down to this, that Hayes agreed as part of the deal to get these votes that he would withdraw federal troops from the southern states. And of course the federal troops had been sent into the southern states after the Civil War to carry out Reconstruction and to keep peace and also protect the interests of African Americans in particular. That ended with the election of Hayes. And this was one of the great scandals in American electoral history. And so we kind of look back and say, gee, it was, you know, that was a long time ago. It was kind of archaic, but it was clearly a turning point moment in history, because most definitely Tilden would have treated Reconstruction differently than Hayes did.
And kind of then enabling 100 years of Jim Crow laws and treating blacks as second-class citizens and so forth.
Absolutely. It opened the doors for that, and again, we can't really say what and how it would have been different if the election had turned the other way, but most likely it would have been different. And those, again, are the fascinating little moments, but so important to the course that the country ultimately did take. You did go from this period in which African Americans in the South and poor white farmers were actually finding some common ground. But once this election took place, any hope of that continuing to happen was destroyed, and with very tragic results, I would say.
Well, you know, one of the things that people say all the time, all the cynical people out there, is that it doesn't matter, you know, who's president. They're all the same. The Democrats are as bad as the Republicans, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, when we talk about American history and how much we know about it, you pointed out in Don't Know Much About History that President Clinton needed a little brush up when he went to visit the beaches in France.
That's right, to Normandy, right, for the D-Day celebrations.
But it's also really apparent that Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin, for instance, know virtually nothing about history. So how terrible would it be if our next president, whether it's another term with our current president or whether we get somebody else, How terrible would it be if they don't know anything?
Well, if they don't know anything, it would worry me. The problem isn't sometimes not so much not knowing anything, but having a very particular view of history, and that's sometimes more dangerous. Maybe, you know, it's like the old saying, a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. When you hear Michelle Bachmann, for instance, say that the founding fathers worked tirelessly to end slavery, that is, first of all, nonsense. Second of all, completely inaccurate. But more important, I think it speaks to a mindset that refutes logic, reason, and that's scary. You can say this leader, that leader, they're all the same, but they're not all the same. And someone who would be capable of making such a statement as that, clearly so at odds with the facts being that five of the first seven American presidents were slaveholders in office, 13 of the first 15 presidents before Lincoln were slaveholders in their life, the fact that because the Constitution was written to give the southern slaveholding states this advantage in three-fifths of a person, the way slaves were counted for apportionment, really gave them an advantage in electoral votes, an advantage in the Congress, that dictated the course of history. To not understand that and to think the opposite is the truth is a dangerous idea. You know, whether Paul Revere rode or not, or why he rode, we can be a little less, you know, concerned about that. It's really the interpretation and the mindset that's more dangerous, I think, than, you know, the factual misstep here or there. You know, that doesn't bother me. I mean, even Michelle Bachmann not knowing that it was Concord, Massachusetts, not Concord, New Hampshire, where the American Revolution started. I can live with that little glitch. But on the other hand, when you have a someone talking about, like the governor of Texas, talking about Texas has a right to secede from the Union because it was a republic, that's a dangerous idea because no such right exists at all. And for the governor of the state of Texas to say such a thing, which is a kind of widely held misconception, is a lot more alarming.
Well, we're talking with Kenneth C. Davis, and his book is Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned. And, you know, it's one of the great books, and everybody should have it on their shelf or in their bathroom, and they could dip in whenever they want. But I have so many more questions. I only got to just a few of them. So I'm going to ask if you might come back and join us again soon for another session.
I would love to come back. It's always my pleasure. I would also like to mention that the book is out now. But you can also find out more about me and my books at don'tknowmuch.com. It's my website where I post very often about the connection between history and the headlines. And I write about historic holidays or major anniversaries, and I don't sell anything there. It's just a place to find some interesting stuff about history and what the connection is between the past and the present.
Well, Ken Davis, thank you so much for being on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me. It's a great pleasure, and I had fun talking to you.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you love the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, you can find us on our podcast page at KUSP.org or on iTunes and Facebook. I want to thank Kenneth C. Davis for being my guest. His book, Don't Know Much About History, is now available in a revised anniversary edition. Production of From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thanks, Francis. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.